Hello.
Hello, is this Mr. Good?
Yes, it is.
Ken McCormick, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks, Ken.
That's good. First, I want to really thank you for the interview. I appreciate the time you're going to give me. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, is it okay if I use your picture from your website?
Yes, sure.
Okay, great.
Do I need to turn anything off here?
No, you sound fine.
Okay, let me just go offline in any case. Thank you.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, you're there all the time. I'm sorry, I've been here all the time waiting.
Oh, no, I thought you were doing something. That's why I was holding on.
I was just in front of me there.
So. Okay, no problem.
Okay.
Okay, let's start the interview then. First of all, I think you have a very unusual background for a UFO investigator, and I think that my readers would like to know more about your musical background. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, my father was a very distinguished violinist. He was, in fact, among the first ever to broadcast recitals on the violin for the new BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, back in the 1920s. And so, obviously, it was in the family, and I started learning when I was about 5 years old.
Well, that's very interesting. You're one of the world's preeminent UFO investigators and authors, and could you tell us about some of the books you've written, including the new book that's about to be released this month?
Okay, well, the first book I wrote actually was George Adamski, The Untold Story, which I co-authored with Lou, that's Lou for Louise, Zinstag, a lovely Swiss friend of mine who was a second cousin of Carl Jung, the great psychologist, with whom she used to discuss the UFO subject, and Adamski in particular. And I just felt that Adamski had been misrepresented quite a bit, and the first part was by Lou, who knew Adamski for many, many years and was his Swiss co-worker, in fact. And she had herself many unusual experiences along the lines of Adamski, together with other co-workers. So she was convinced that he was very truthful about most things, but she became disturbed, as did many of the other co-workers much later in his life, by some of the things he was saying. But she will always stand by the basic premise that he actually had contact with extraterrestrials and he met them right here on planet Earth. And my part was a sort of critical evaluation of Adamski's claims. And I have to also confess that I myself have had about three or four encounters with beings I am convinced were from elsewhere. And one of whom, at least, was very, very similar to one of the female occupants of the spaceships upon which Adamski flew way back in the mid-1950s. And that was absolutely extraordinary. And that experience was actually on the borders of Arizona and California back in November of 1963 when I was touring with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. And It's a long story, but if you want to get into that later, I'd be glad. And then in 1967, I had a far more conclusive event. Again, telepathy was involved. It was a proof that there are highly telepathic beings around who know one's every thought. And that really clinched it for me, and that was back in February of 1967 when I was touring, I was actually giving a series of concerts with the London Symphony Orchestra in Carnegie Hall in February of 67 when I had that second and sort of cathartic encounter, which convinced me that there are indeed some beings from elsewhere living on this planet.
Well, maybe you could tell us, what was your first experience that really got you into the field of UFO investigation?
Well, it goes back to 1955, Ken. I've always been mad about aircraft and space travel. So when an American cousin, an interesting guy actually, Edmund C. Berkeley, he was the first, I believe, to produce a magazine on computers back in the 40s, and it was called Computers and Automation. We thought he was completely bonkers, but he was a brilliant man, Harvard graduate, and he gave me this book on flying saucers in 1955, and it was called The Flying Saucers Are Real by Major Donald Kehoe, and he said, Timothy, you love planes and spaceships, you need to know about flying saucers. So that began it. I read the book, and I read all these reports by airline pilots, near collisions with UFOs, jet interceptors sent to chase UFOs all over the place, and radar confirmed sightings, air traffic controllers concerned all over the states and abroad. And that was it. I was hooked. And then, of course, at that time I was at school, so I couldn't get into any investigation at that time. That started in 1961 when I read Captain Edward Ruppelt's famous book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, which I think is a great classic. It's absolutely, even by today's standard, it's an extraordinary work, given that at that, you know, that Ruppelt was an intelligence officer, and he was the first head of Project Blue Book, which, mm-hmm. as you know, started back in 1952. And he was convinced that we were indeed being visited, and all the proof was there.
Okay. I saw something that you were writing about in your new book that I had never heard of before, and it caught my eye. You mentioned that research was conducted into UFOs by Mussolini in the 1930s.
That's correct. Well, it started with the landing of an unconventional aircraft, very unconventional, quite obviously, which caused a lot of concern. This was 1933. I think it was near Milan, the crash landing, the first UFO crash retrieval story, I think, really. Dates back to 1933, way before Roswell. And Mussolini, who was a pilot, of course he was at the time, he was a sort of fascist dictator of Italy, but he was also a very keen pilot, and he became very gripped by these first reports, and it continued. There were reports in 1936, Italian pilots chasing UFOs, could never get anywhere near them, and quite vivid descriptions. And I forget exactly how long it lasted, but I think it was certainly continued into the Second World War, as far as I recollect. It was started in 1933, and it was called the Special Research Unit Number 33, or RS 33 for short, and it was headed by Marconi, the great Italian engineer, who, you know, was one of the first to sort of deal with radio broadcasting and all that. And there were many other people, like astronomers involved, and actually Marconi didn't get involved in many of the investigations. Perhaps he had what he felt were more important things to do, but certainly, you know, this was a top-secret unit that was established at that time to investigate the UFO phenomenon.
You know, it's funny. A lot of us think we know most of this historical data, and it turns out that new stuff just keeps popping up. Most people in this country believe that Roswell was the first crash of a UFO with aliens aboard. Yet in your book, you claim that 2 years before Roswell, a UFO crashed near Detroit. Maybe you would tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I learned this from a pilot. Let me tell you the story. In the late summer of 1945, war was still going on, and the Japanese had been sending these Fugo balloons, balloon bombs, over the states, and a few of them reached as far as Michigan, but mostly they sort of fell in the Pacific Ocean. They drifted just by, you know, the air currents. And a few of them were successful, but only about two or three people died on examining these balloon bombs when they came down on the West Coast. But in July 1945, there was what was considered balloon bombs over Detroit area, an Army airfield, Selfridge, I believe, Selfridge Army Airfield, and it was given to us of the pilots, you know, who they actually sort of asked for a volunteer, send up a volunteer to chase, to shoot down these Japanese things. They were convinced they were balloons, and there were quite a few of them over this airfield. So who volunteered but a Free French Air Force pilot, who was, of course, on detachment with the United States Army Air Forces at the time as a Thunderbolt trainer on P-47D and P-47N, I think, Thunderbolts. And he went up, and he said, he told me he took this to absolutely beyond its service ceiling, you know, full blast on the throttle, and eventually got one of these so-called balloons in his sights, and he let rip with the eight machine guns in the wings of the Thunderbolt. And suddenly this thing, which had been, it looked like a sphere when he first watched it, and then it suddenly flipped on its side and shot off at a phenomenal speed at right angles. And as he said to me, you know, this was no balloon. So you see, a Frenchman was the first to try and defend the United States against alien invaders.
According to your book...
And then, sorry, I need to pick you up on your original question about the crash of a plane. Actually, I think it was there was a crash in... Oh, gosh, it was near... Colorado, near Denver. This guy, Jean Kisling, Commander Jean Kisling, told me that he learned that a few weeks later he thought that a jet had been sent up to shoot down a UFO, and the plane itself was knocked out of the sky and crashed somewhere near Denver.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't actually a UFO which came down near Denver at that time, but I have a case from August of 1945 which took place in New Mexico, which I've gone into in a little detail. It's quite an interesting story. It took place, I'm trying to think exactly where, but there were these two boys, there were young boys at the time, and they were working on the farm with, you know, with their families and things on horseback, looking after the farm, and the guys' names were Jose Padilla and Remy Barker. And the actual date of the event, it was just, I think, sort of August, late August, after the first atomic bomb was exploded, and it's near a place called San Antonito, which is near San Antonio, New Mexico, near the border. And they were on horseback, and they saw this brilliant light accompanied by a crunching sound, and eventually came upon a dull gray, they said it was an avocado-shaped craft with a protuberance toward one end, and through which could be seen smoke from the burning wreckage. Sorry about that, just my facts gave.
All right, that's okay. That's okay, no problem.
And they said that sort of scattered among the debris were pieces of shiny tinfoil-like metal. and there was, through a gash in the side of the craft, there came signs of movement, and it appeared, and they were looking from a distance, but they definitely were humanoid creatures moving around, Rimi Bakker told me, in very quick darting movements, making squeaking sounds. They said it was like a rabbit that was being killed. And as it was getting late, the boys headed back to the ranch to tell the owner, Faustino Padilla, what had happened. And he said that he and others would check it out in a day or two, an odd reaction to an air crash and possible injured occupants, one would think. But anyway, 2 days later, the owner of the ranch, accompanied by a state policeman and the boys, headed for the crash site. And at first they couldn't find anything. The craft had been covered with dirt and debris to sort of disguise it. The creatures had gone, and the huge debris field had been largely cleared and raked over, although the craft actually remained where it had come to rest. Evidently the army had learned of the incident, and they came to pick it up later. And Rimi Bakker and Jose Padilla were able to watch the actual recovery operation from a distance with binoculars. And eventually, when there was one period of a few hours when it wasn't being guarded, the soldiers went down to the local bar, I believe. I mean, they didn't know what they had at this time, quite frankly, but... Mm-hmm. Apparently, they claimed to have got inside the craft, or at least Jose told me that he clambered onto the lowboy where this craft had been strapped, ready to be taken away to White Sands the next day. And they actually prized a souvenir piece from what appeared to be a bulkhead. I've seen that. I've examined it. I'm not convinced. It certainly appears to me very Earth-like. It looks like a bracket of some kind. It's 12 inches long, weighs 15 ounces, and contains a number of holes for fasteners of some kind.
Has it ever been tested?
Yes, it has. A section cut off, as well as acid tests, reveal it to be 200 series aluminum or similar, which is hardly conclusive. And to me, even though it's very evidently, it's very light, it is a bracket of some kind with countersunk places for where, screws could go in or bolts or whatever. And, I'm just not convinced by that. But certainly the witnesses sound sincere to me. It's maybe that the craft was something primitive. I don't know, but they were young boys at the time. I think about 9 and 11, something like that, off the top of my head. But, definitely these creatures looked very, very strange. And Rimi told me that the creatures, when they saw them, initially had sort of like dragonfly-type eyes, as far as they could make out from a distance. So there's something odd there. And, of course, there were crashes in World War World War II as well in Hawaii. I've got a case.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and there was one in Poland when a craft came to ground with a very female humanoid type occupant on board, and she asked this guy if he could help her clear the sand. This craft had come down and buried half impacted in the sand on the Baltic coast, and I find that actually a very, very convincing story indeed. It's very compelling indeed. So, there were things before Roswell, and even Roswell, yes, we're getting more information now, but I think the really sensational one was probably Aztec in March of 1948, when the craft that was recovered was more or less in perfect condition.
Right.
And, the scientists really had a great deal more time to find out over the years, or even decades probably, what it was comprised of.
Okay, I know you covered this business about the bracket, and I'd just like to ask one more question. You said that was aluminum type 200?
Yeah, 200 series.
Did they have aluminum type 200 in 1945?
I wouldn't know. I'd like to know.
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? I'm going to check that out myself.
Well, they didn't say it was, Ken. They said it was similar to 200 series aluminum.
Gotcha. Okay, according to your book, NASA had alien bones and an alien skull on the premises in 1977.
Yes.
I don't want you to name any names, but could you tell me how you went about finding something like this out?
Well, the story was published in a German book by a very good author. I can't think of his name off the top of my head at the moment, but if I can get to that relevant passage in my book, I shall let you know. But I find the evidence very convincing. If I can just find the name of this book here, it's Andreas von Reti. Okay,
uh-huh.
And the book was called Das Alien Imperium UFO Geheimnisse der USA, published by Lang & Müller in Germany in 1995, and I had the extracts translated.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it very compelling because this Polish biophysicist, in 1974 was asked, together with a small team of scientists on contract to NASA, to analyze some extraordinary materials. And the materials were really like nothing they had encountered before. And then in 1977, the same team met again at NASA's JPL at Caltech in Pasadena. And during this party, the official who was retiring took these biophysicists. There was a team. They were French. I think there were half a dozen of them, French, Italian, Polish, and British. And they were taken to a vault three levels below ground level and into this top secret vault, apparently, where it was protected by a heavy door with two seals, and they were taken into this room about 8 to 10 meters in length and over 4 meters wide. And the first thing they saw was two small shiny plexiglass containers, in one of the two of which was a hip bone, a bit broken off the bottom part of it, and it looked like a child's hip bone, but the form was different, and the bone structure too, and shape and color were different. In that the bone was not typical yellowish white, but light grayish white, said this guy who's given the pseudonym of Dr. Chris. And he said that the cavity for the bone marrow was smaller, and the structures where the muscles would have been attached were formed differently. And then in the second plexiglass container, he says, we saw the fragment of a skull, maybe one-third or 40% of it. The segment included the eye socket and part of the right half of the skull. The head was about as big as that of an elderly child. It looked human-like, but derived neither from a child nor from an ape. The color was different from that of the hip bone. It appeared lighter. I don't know, some parts of the bone had been damaged by fire. In any case, the color was not the same. And he said that the part of the skull protecting the brain was much thinner than a human's skull. Now, in that context, it's interesting that the nurse who attended one of the autopsies at Roswell Army Airfield, according to Glenn Dennis, described the skull of one of the beings as being flexible. So that's interesting.
Yes, that is interesting.
And these exhibits were given a small printed explanation. It said from the first and second incidents in New Mexico. And the team of scientists tried to get the American chap in charge, who's retiring, to say what this meant, and he said, that's highly secret. We're not really allowed to talk about that.
Well,
I find that also even more interesting, I think, is that Dr. Chris found that later that in 1947 there had been altogether at least two spaceships with at least three crew that had crashed. And he added that one member of the second crew had survived. I don't know anything specific about his fate. The mm-hmm. first three beings were totally charred, whereas the other two corpses were mostly preserved, for example, the skull, skin, and bones. There were also parts of clothing found. As I learned from biologists, their blood is similar to ours, but shows a totally different reaction toward oxygen. So inside the spaceship, they must breathe a mixture of helium and oxygen, since nitrogen, for whatever reason, is really not good for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Andreas von Reichy, and I'm absolutely sure that that is a very, very genuine case.
Right. Well, I think it's amazing how that particular nurse that you're talking about, how every record of hers was completely erased from Roswell to make her a non-entity, you know what I mean?
Well, yes, it's interesting. You know that Glenn Dennis at one time gave out the name of Safe, or Self, I think. I forget. I'm sorry. Forgive me.
Oh, that's quite all right.
Checking, getting all my facts. I think it was Naomi Self, I think. Anyway, according to the Air Force, according to their investigations, all the information Glenn Dennis provides actually completely accurately describes a First Lieutenant Eileen M. Fanton. And so I've actually reproduced a photograph from the U.S. Air Force, Roswell Case Closed book.
I've done a little research on this myself.
I think that's very interesting. So, the jury is still open on that one.
Okay, I didn't write this question down, but it comes to mind, With all these UFO crashes, many people believe that even though these ships have advanced beams flying them, that because of the type of propulsion they're using, like anti-gravity propulsion, that they're technically unstable at slower speeds, and this causes some of the crashes. Do you believe that?
I think it's quite likely. I mean, it's sort of been surmised that the new high-powered radar in New Mexico, to sort of defend White Sands area, because that was the area where, of course, the first bomb was, the first A-bomb was exploded, and a lot of other things involving UFOs. Actually, UFOs were very busy in New Mexico, there's no question, because of our developments in with nuclear weapons and so forth. So they were buzzing all over the place. And I think also, in addition to the possibility that radar took some of them down, I think others were actually shot down later on using more sophisticated weaponry. I've heard all sorts of rumors, but at that time, what I am told by John Andy Kistner, who's a former state representative for, I forget the name of the town now, Las Cruces, that's right, yeah. He was also, in the defense industry, very well connected, and he gave me a lot of extremely important new information relating to the air disasters which followed the first tests of V-2 rockets. And there's a case actually described, and I've reproduced, thanks to Andy Kistner's research. He kindly gave me permission to use as much as I wanted. It's all his great research. Actual newspaper articles confirming that peculiar phenomena were responsible for bringing down prematurely a V-2 rocket. And this was several months before Roswell.
Mm.
And so I reproduced the actual newspaper there, which shows that the director of the White Sands Missile Test Center confirms this officially. And what happened then was that there was a renewed effort on the part of the Army Air Forces, as they still were, to bring some of these things down for evaluation. And there's been a conflict ever since, in my opinion, with some or even several extraterrestrial species. But anyway, that set off when we started firing at them and actually succeeded, I'm told, in bringing down a few of them, including the two that came down somewhere in the vicinity of Roswell and other areas, as you know the story there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think all the facts have been released, but... I was told what happened was in May, sort of May, June 1947, some of these things, these craft, were knocked out of the sky, and the one that came down at Roswell, I'm told by Andy Kistner, took several days before it came down, and several of these craft were seen wobbling around the sky, literally, as if they were sort of in trouble, and then they came down in New Mexico, and retrieval teams were sent out.
So apparently we have something that'll interfere with the magnetic field.
Or whatever. But yeah. What I'm told brought those down. They did try regular anti-aircraft shots, but they found the most effective thing was proximity-fused weapons, which you know are sort of geared to explode at a predetermined distance,
right?
Being on getting close to the target, and apparently that's what happened. It brought several of these things down, and then all hell let loose because they started retaliating. And not just in the United States, but worldwide. Again, I reproduced some of the actual articles. Some of them are a bit difficult to read, but you can get the gist of the whole thing.
Well, that was a question I was going to ask you, believe it or not.
Okay, yeah.
you're going to answer the question between the years 52 and 56 about the 1,773 aircraft accidents?
I'm going to talk about that, but first of all, this is in 1947. Before Roswell, hundreds of aircraft crashes occurred, not just in the United States, but all over the world. And there's no doubt in my mind that these crashes were indeed UFO-related.
Mm.
It was retaliation on their part. Now, what I found particularly disturbing when I was presented with this massive evidence, I mean, it's understandable, you know, if interceptors were sent up and knocked out of the sky, which has happened many times, or made to disappear or whatever, but there were airliners that were unable to get off the ground, and this happened on many occasions around the world, and unexplained crashes. And the official explanations were that the planes were running out of fuel. Well, you don't get that many planes running out of fuel, you know, when they've just been fully fueled and not even got into the air. So there were these many, many unexplained accidents, and I eventually managed... thanks to Richard H. Hall, the great researcher who knew Donald Kehoe, he learnt from Dr. Alevo Fontes the actual Defense Department statistics for 1952 to late 1956 on aircraft crashes. Now, interestingly, these statistics reveal that out of 18,662 major military aircraft accidents, most of which incidentally involved the latest jet fighters and other interceptor aircraft, 1,773 were due to unknown factors, and that is officially confirmed in the United States Defense Department statistics.
That's incredible.
It's also incredible that there were 18,662 major military aircraft accidents in that period.
Yeah, it sure is. Tell us a little bit about the interceptors that disappeared. What I'm curious about is, were there any pattern to their disappearance? In other words,
yes.
did they show... electrical problems as they get closer to these disks?
Yes, absolutely. On many cases, I mean, the classic one for me, the most interesting one, and I think there have probably been hundreds, if not, well, I would put it conservatively, since the 40s, I would say maybe several thousand unexplained accidents and disappearances. But I think the most interesting one occurred in I think it was June of 1953, when an F-96C Starfire was sent up from Otis Air Force Base in Massachusetts, on the coast of Massachusetts, to chase an aerial intruder. I mean, this thing was happening. These things were happening every day at that time. I mean, there was nothing exceptional about it. It was quite normal. I mean, and pilots were sent up to investigate these things and to shoot them down. And this was in June of that year, 1953. Starfire was sent up. There's a pilot sitting in the front. In the rear seat is the radar operator and observer. And they'd got to just over 1,000 feet to chase this intruder away, this unexplained flying object, when all power failed, absolutely everything. The engine failed, the whole lot. And the rear seat guy is supposed to eject first, but nothing happened, or we just simply don't know what happened. But at any rate, there was no time to mess around, so the pilot in the front pulled the seat ejection canopy. That shot off, then he ejected, and he came down. His parachute managed to open in time. He landed in a populated area, suburban area, fully expecting, you know, the rear seater to come down after him. What happened? Nothing. There was no sign of the radar observer, no sign of the Starfire jet. The only thing that they found was the cockpit canopy, which of course had been ejected at the same, just prior to the pilot having ejected. So I find that a very, very convincing story. And I know one of the investigators, I mean, Major Donald Kehoe investigated it. Bob Pratt, who died in recent years, sadly, was a great researcher. He was convinced that it was very real, based on the people he spoke to. So that's just one of many, many such cases.
Well,
and I think they're probably still happening, but we don't get to hear about them so much.
Well, one thing I've noticed is that, at least with the American military, they have tried to harden all their electronic and computer parts in all of their planes. Now it makes me wonder if really the main reason they were doing this was because of UFO attacks.
Ken, you could be right. I hadn't thought of that, but what I do know, of course, is that there are EM effects. Well, weapons that the military have, certainly in the United States.
That's right. Yes.
I forget the name of the experiments.
Well, they get EM when they explode nuclear weapons too. You know.
Right. Okay, but I know that there was some tests being done. I'm sorry, I can't. EMP.
Right.
Electromagnetic pulse.
Right.
Tests have been conducted.
That's right.
For decades. And they need to be able to counter that. So that might equally well involve, you know, electromagnetic pulse guns that we're using perhaps to counter the alien threat. I mean, there's all sorts
absolutely.
Of possibilities. The sky is open, but there is definitely a conflict, and that is one of the reasons, in my opinion, for the extreme secrecy attached to the subject.
Well, one thing that caught my eye was you talked about Project Blue Book.
Mm-hmm.
Giving camera setups to a B-36 bomber that photographed a large
UFO.
That's
extraordinary.
Now, most of us that know anything about UFOs have always thought that Project Blue Book was like impotent, you know, that they really didn't do anything except...
There was a public Project Blue Book, and there was a covert Project Blue Book, and indeed there were many compartments, sometimes just consisting of three or four people. High-powered scientists. I've listed some of the various projects at that time that were going on, and there was a special group within Blue Book. I've given some of the details of that in the book. I mean, I don't know if I can lay my hands on it, but I have produced a document in connection with submarine encounters with UFOs or USOs in 1952, and I reproduce an interesting document which I got under the Freedom of Information Act decades ago, but it's very interesting because it, if I can just find the right page here, I wish I had a photographic memory.
Don't we all?
I think, but anyway, if I can't find it, it was a top secret group within Blue Book, and I think it was AFOXN, something like that. I'm just sort of probably just coming up to it, but no guarantee. No, I can't. I think it's in a chapter on naval intelligence. Sorry, I can't find it.
That's quite all right.
It's just difficult with a phone in one hand and
of course.
But in any event, to answer the other part of your question, which was about Blue Book itself, and you wanted to know about this case, sort of Dakota's case an RB-36H Peacemaker 10-engined bomber, which of course can had provisions for carrying nuclear weapons. And there's not a precise date given, but Richard Haynes and others investigated this case thoroughly and spoke to at least one of the crew members, and it's very convincing. And this bomber encountered a UFO which came alongside. It was about 100 feet in diameter, not that high actually, and there were lots of colored lights along the rim blinking in sequence, and about three portholes on a sort of a low dome on top of this thing. And the interesting thing is that there was a 17-man crew on board, as well as a five-man relief crew or something like that on board, and they all saw this thing, and it was there, I think, at a guess, for about 8 minutes, during which time these guys on board took photographs, and special cameras, I know that, were given to them, apparently by Blue Book intelligence officers, to take photographs in the event of such an encounter. And sure enough, this happened. And as soon as they landed, everything was confiscated, of course, the films. Hopefully we'll see them someday.
I'm going to ask you something out of sequence here, because I'm very interested in this question. The NASA space program seems to be going, well, basically nowhere as far as manned exploration is concerned. But I've always had the feeling that maybe there's a covert military program.
Absolutely.
And that program has already landed people on Mars and maybe built bases on the moon, and we just don't know about it.
I tend to go along with that, Ken. I can't say I know that for sure, but that's my guess too. There's a public NASA and there's a very private, very secret NASA. There's no question about that in my mind.
Well, one of the things that seems to have convinced me of this, it's something you probably don't know anything about because it's on my website. I was going through the pictures of the two rovers that were on Mars, and I found a perfect footprint in the soil on Mars, and I've made it available to anybody who wants to look at it on my site, and it seems to be a dress shoe of all things.
I'll take a look at it if you can, send me that link, if you haven't already.
I haven't, but I will, though, if you're interested.
Sure.
You cite several instances of presidents either meeting with aliens or viewing their dead bodies.
Absolutely.
And there's also a story that I heard about President Nixon taking his good friend, comedian Jackie Gleason, to see bodies of aliens.
That's right. Well, I mean, that's not published for the first time. That was at Homestead Air Force Base in Florida, and Gleason came back, and his wife confirms that, he was white as a sheet and quite shocked and described that story.
Well, here's the thing. I've read many times that U.S. presidents were kept out of the UFO loop, and it comes to mind, a story comes to mind about President Carter going to Bush at the time, who was the head of the CIA, I believe, and asking for more information on UFOs and being shut out,
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, although certainly not all presidents are briefed fully. I think a few of them are not briefed at all necessarily, Clinton being one. I mean, he tried, but, presidents who haven't served in the military are not very popular with the guys controlling the situation. And Clinton certainly wasn't. But there is brand new information, which I got from a very reliable source who was attached to the White House staff, particularly that connected with Air Force One, informed me that in 1961-62, President Kennedy requested to be taken to see the alien bodies and craft. And his wish was granted, and it was a top-secret mission. I'm not given dates. I was given the name of one person who, unfortunately, I've misspelt in the book. I was told it was a McHugh, and that was the name that was given to me, but the chap questioned the spelling afterwards, and in fact, it was McHugh. That's M small c, H big H, U G H, General Godfrey T. McHugh, who was in charge of this top secret mission, along with many other generals on the plane. And JFK was taken to Tyndall Air Force Base, that's TYN November DALL, in Florida, to view the bodies at a special medical facility. And I don't know any more than that, I'm afraid. But I think, in view of later developments, there might well be a connection there. That's my opinion, based on what I've learned anyway.
Well, for those of us that are old enough to remember Stuart Whitman, I don't know if you are, but I certainly am.
Yes.
Tell us the story about his encounter with these aliens.
Oh, my goodness, yes. This was, if I can find it, this was in 1965, I believe, during the... it was during the great blackout in the northeast.
I remember that well. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to... I've got it here. Here we are. Page 254. And he was staying in New York at the time, and I can remember the stories in the American press about all that. But I thought, you know, for the first time, I'd include this story since so few people seem to be aware of it. And it was November. I think it was the great American power blackout of 9th of November, and. That Stuart Whitman was alone in his hotel room in New York City during the blackout and was awoken just before dawn by a whistling sound, which from his 12th floor window, outside of which two strange objects could be seen. One of them was orange, one the other blue, he explained to a reporter. He said they gave off a strange luminescent light, so I couldn't see if there were portholes or who was in them. And then he heard them speaking as if they were on a loudspeaker, and they spoke to him in English. It may not have been audible to anyone else, he said. I was probably tuned into the right wavelength. They said they wanted to talk to me because I appeared to have no malice or hate in my soul. They said they were fearful of Earth because Earthlings were messing around with unknown quantities and might disrupt the balance of the universe or their planet. They said the blackout was just a little demonstration of their power and that they could do a lot more with almost no effort. It served as a warning. They said they could stop our whole planet from functioning. They asked me to do what I could to fight malice, prejudice, and hate on Earth, and then they took off. I felt elated, he continued. I wasn't even shocked, standing by the window and awake the entire time. I don't know why they picked me as a contact, but I'll swear off a Bible that I saw them out there and that they talked to me.
That is quite a story.
Isn't it just?
Oh, it sure is.
I wonder if he's contactable these days. He's probably...
I don't even know if he's alive, do you?
I don't. I think I'll have to Google him.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, I'd be interested in what he has to say, too.
Yeah.
You talk about UFO activity in the Vietnam War.
Yes.
Could you tell us some of the biggest cases that you know about?
Well, one of the most interesting ones was given to me by... Commander Willard Miller. He was one of the Disclosure Project witnesses, but he gave me the story. I went specially to meet him in Florida to get the story from him, and he said that he was on board this the USS Leary. It's a U.S. Navy destroyer during the 1969 cruise in the Vietnam War. And Will was an ensign at that time, U.S. Naval Reserve, and he's now retired at the rank of commander. And he and some crew members saw this an object at the distance in the Gulf of Tonkin above the ground. And they thought that they were sort of wooden Vietnamese fishing craft with lights and things. So, but then this thing started moving around in a completely different sort of glow to the one coming from the fishing boats. And it then came towards them. It moved from above the water to below. It entered the water and moved rapidly toward our destroyer, he says, at 45 degrees to the bow, passing directly beneath the ship. We ran to the starboard side to see if the object had emerged, but there was nothing. Nothing was seen on our sonar, our surface radar, our electronic countermeasure system. Whatever it wasn't a submarine. We decided against waking the captain, but I directed that a deck deck log entry be made of the events, since we were required, like all naval vessels, to report any unusual observations. All the ship's original logs were always retranscribed for official submission. This is what Will told me.
Mm-hmm.
Years later, I reviewed USS Leary's logs at the Naval Historical Center for the period of the incident, but there was absolutely no record of the event in the official logbook. Now, this is actually quite common.
It is quite
naval
common,
episodes.
Yes.
I've got many cases in the book, including a case in 1971. On a huge destroyer, in which you know, the logs are either changed or just
this was a very common practice on the aircraft carrier Roosevelt, which
Absolutely.
Saw many UFOs.
Yes, yes. I think there's sort of correlations between some of the sightings over low-level sightings over aircraft carriers, like in 1971 when. I've got the detailed report of an officer who held top secret clearance about a huge UFO which disrupted all operations on the USS John F. Kennedy. And that's a compelling case. And I think probably what's at issue here and of interest to the UFOs is that those aircraft carriers were probably carrying hydrogen weapons at that time.
I'm sure they were.
That's my opinion. And they're just letting us know that they know and that they can paralyze all our systems, if it came to it. But there's also this report in the book by a general. I think there's a press conference. He's asked about UFOs. This was in the 1973 press conference. General George Brown, who was chief of staff of the Air Force at the time, said he's asked about, "What's the Air Force's position on the UFO business?" "I don't know whether this story has ever been told or not," replied the general. "They weren't called UFOs. They were called enemy helicopters. And they were only seen at night, and they were only seen in certain places. They were seen up around the demilitarized zone in the early summer of 68, and this resulted in quite a little battle. And in the course of this, an Australian destroyer which took a hit, and we never found any enemy. We only found ourselves when this had all been sorted out."
Mm.
"And this caused some shooting there, and there was no enemy at all involved, but we always reacted, and it was always after dark." And he says, "We found that they had moved the radar in, and the army started to work, and we finally got that radar out of there, and then they quit worrying about their problem." But anyway, I mean, it goes on. I think, obviously, there's a lot of stuff going on in Korea and in the Second World War. And
I think now we're getting more sophisticated. We realize what's going on.
Yes, indeed.
I was interested in that paragraph in your book where you talked about a triangular craft, which we think of mostly as just sailing across the sky noiselessly and not bothering anybody, attacking a Russian radar facility.
Yes.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, if I can just think, I think it was in 1989, 1990, something like that. Again, I need to find the page, but...
You have a great memory, I must say.
Well, thank you very much, Ken, but at the same time, I'm checking in the book all the facts, because I like to get my facts right for your audience. And I think, let's just have a look, I think it was at a place called Kuibyshev in September of 1990. This is a very interesting case, and it was given to me by a journalist and engineer, a great friend of mine, Nikolai Lebedev, in St. Petersburg, and he investigated this case. It happened on 13th of September at a radar station, 800 kilometers east-southeast of Moscow, when... the radar picked up a large target at a range of no more than 100 kilometers. And then it seemed to scatter on the screen, and at 42 kilometers it changed into a strong signal representing an isosceles triangle. Men came out of the underground bunker, and the unknown object passed directly over them at a height of no more than 10 meters. This is what some of the military people said. "We could see it clearly, since the perimeter of the base is always lit by searchlights. The bottom of the object was smooth, but not mirror-like. It was like a thick layer of soot. We did not notice any openings, portholes, or landing gear, but we saw three whitish-blue beams of light. The corners of the object were slightly rounded. Now, two sentries were sent to investigate, because this was a radar station, a portable radar
right.
unit.
Mm-hmm.
And to cut a long story short, this thing actually landed near the fence by the short-range radar post, and it beamed light towards the number 12 radar unit and destroyed it. The beam of light, interestingly, passed right through one of the sentries without injuring him at all. He had absolutely no effect.
Wow.
But other people there at the time had missing time. They disappeared.
Mm.
It's an extraordinary case.
Yes, it certainly is.
They said that each side of the triangle was about 15 meters in length. About 50, at least 50 yards, I think. And it landed with a soft rustling sound. The thickness of the triangle was about 10 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very interesting event.
Could you tell us about the event at Dublin Airport? That it seems to be another interesting event.
This is one of the very disturbing cases, which I got from Ireland's top researchers, Carl Nally and Dermot Butler. And this was in early January of 2004, when an Aer Lingus Boeing 737-400 series twin-engined airliner was on its final approach to Dublin Airport. And according to witnesses, including the pilots on another aircraft, an Airbus, 5 or 6 miles behind in the landing pattern, a very large violet-colored triangle came up from the ground. This was at night. This was at 8 p.m. It came up from the ground and described a series of harassing maneuvers right in front of this Boeing 737 on its final approach. And to cut a long story short, the outside air temperature was heated up to about 164 degrees centigrade. There was violent turbulence. The wings of the plane were crinkled. The landing, the air brakes wouldn't raise properly. And so they had to make an emergency landing, fortunately with no bad results. But it was very, very alarming for the crew. And a similar thing happened. The same triangular craft was seen harassing another plane 2 hours later at 10 p.m., again on the final approach. Now, we don't have any names of the crews because everyone's frightened of talking about it. It's officially denied, but even though we know the actual registration number of the airliner, and we know that it was taken for repairs after this incident, but everything is denied at an official level. And you know, one can see why, because if this came out officially,
nobody would be flying anymore.
Well,
sure.
just as you're beginning to think it's safe to go back in
right.
the airport.
Yeah, you're right. Before I get into the next question, do you think we landed on the moon? We actually did land on the moon.
Absolutely.
Okay, because a lot of people say, you know, the backgrounds aren't right, the shadows aren't right.
No, that's nonsense. What happens is pictures get touched up, just as they do in photographs of models and all sorts of things. You know, you want to present the product in the best possible light, and if that means manipulating the pictures, it'll be done. But I think also the thing about shadows and everything is that, you know, shadows do vary. I mean, unless you know the exact sort of contours of the ground, the territory and everything, it's very difficult to say that shadow shouldn't look like this or it shouldn't look like that.
Well, one of the things people complain about is they claim they found the same background in some of the pictures, but the pictures were taken at different locations, you know.
I'd need to look at the individual frames. But, you know, all sorts of claims are made, you know, that how come they didn't suffer from radiation? I mean, for heaven's sakes, those spacesuits were very, very well insulated against radiation and meteorites and things like that.
What type of advancements do you think that we have made from this alien technology?
Oh, well, put it like this. Ben Rich, who was sort of chief engineer of the Skunk Works at Burbank, you know, Black Project aircraft,
yes, I understand.
And such as the stealth planes and everything. He was asked this at during a lecture, and he discussed it, mentioned in more detail after a lecture at UCLA. And one of the people there, I mean, I spoke to one of the guys who was actually there, and they asked further. And Ben Rich, the gist of it is, Ben Rich says, we now have the technology to go to the stars. And this was, you know, like 10
years
ago.
I've heard that, yes.
Or more, you know, but it's just a question of a few equations. We now have the technology. So that gives me the clue that I think we have very sophisticated technology, whether that's with the approval of the aliens or with the, I don't know, but I think there is definitely a liaison program. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Do you know who Kelly Johnson is, or was, I should say?
Yes, he was also involved in the,
right. Well, here's what I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Kelly Johnson was the main designer of the SR-71 Blackbird.
Right.
That plane was so advanced that it still holds the speed records today.
Yes.
Do you think that any of the technology used in that plane may have come from alien technology?
I doubt it, but it's quite possible that some propulsive devices are test, used as a test bed in some of our more advanced aircraft. I mean, you've heard of the Aurora and things like that.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
There are planes, there are top secret planes flying, you know, these 20 years
sure.
before they're unveiled. But I think beyond all that, beyond the sort of hypersonic vehicles and everything, I think we have some sophisticated, what do they call them, lifting bodies, or aircraft or spacecraft or whatever. And then there's the indication provided by a friend of mine who I feel very, very sorry for. This is Gary McKinnon, the world's top military hacker.
Right.
I call him Gary Hackinnon, but he's a lovely guy. He's very sorry for what he did, and it's dreadful. The poor chap faces, it's been said up to 60, 70 years in prison, and the extradition is going ahead, apparently. I don't know the latest up-to-date on that. But,
well, Nick Pope said that it was still ongoing. He couldn't comment on it when I spoke to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the latest I got.
It's awful. I mean, because according to my information, the extradition treaty has not been passed by both houses in the Congress. I don't think. I'm not sure about that. And the Brits are none too happy about it because we still can't extradite people from your country.
Right. I don't blame you.
So it's a one-way system, you know. And there's Enron 3 who are still in prison. I mean, you can wait up to 2 or 3 years before you get to trial.
Right.
You know, and...
I agree with you 100%, believe me.
But Gary, I think, as you probably know, and it's in the last chapter of my book, and the most interesting thing he discovered, I think, if I can lay my hands on it right here, he said that for him, I should add, by the way, I mean, I did talk to someone in Washington and pleaded for leniency concerning this, but unfortunately, there's not a lot of sympathy for hackers in the military.
No, they want him, and that's the bottom line, unfortunately.
But anyway... I said, well, you must see the positive side of this. I mean, Gary did actually expose the weak security of the American military systems using Windows, for example. You know, it's not the most secure system for starters, and there are people no passwords in some cases. People have neglected to protect their data with that. You know.
Plus, they put in all these back doors that he discovered.
But the most interesting thing he told me related to the Air Force Space Command, which I'm convinced is sort of probably in charge of this development you were talking about later, which we are surmising that there is a top secret space program apart from the public one that you know about. And this is what he told me. He said, I found a list of officers' names under the heading non-terrestrial officers.
Yes, I saw that. I saw that.
He doesn't mean little green men. He says, I think it means he's not Earth-based. I found a list of fleet-to-fleet transfers and a list of ship names. I looked them up. They weren't U.S. Navy ships. What I saw made me believe they have some kind of spaceship off-planet. And he sort of expanded on this to me. He said, on finding the first image on my PC, the Earth, or at least a blue and white planet with no continents visible, filled two-thirds of the screen. Midway between the camera, he puts that in parentheses, and the planet hung a cigar-shaped object with geodesic domes above, below, and to the left and right. I didn't see any rivets, seams, or telemetry antennae. So I think that's very interesting indeed.
Very interesting. Listen, at this point, I've been talking to you for over an hour now. I love this, and I could go on a lot longer, but I don't want to take advantage of you. How do you feel about this?
That's okay. I'm okay for about another 25 minutes, something like that.
Oh, okay, great then. Let's see. I wanted to ask you this question. You feel, from your book, I get the feeling that you feel that we could be attacked at any minute. Am I correct, or is this an erroneous assumption?
I didn't mean to imply that. Certainly, there's always that possibility, but things are going on all the time. There is definitely still a conflict situation.
Mm-hmm.
But
Well, here's what I wanted to ask you in relation to that anyway. How do you feel that we could possibly protect ourselves from people that would be so much more advanced than us and could just sit off in space and bombard the Earth?
Well, they can do things in a more subtle way, like take over by, we hear about the abduction phenomenon. I mean, what protection do we have against that, for heaven's sake?
That's for sure.
You know?
Right.
And things can be done in a very subtle way, you know. What is the abduction program for? Now, I've thought long and hard about this. I've had abduction-type experiences myself. I'm not saying I have been abducted, but I have had abduction-type experiences over a very, very long period. So I'm familiar with many of the symptoms, at least. And I don't know. I think definitely hybridization is the name of the game, but supposing, for whose benefit, I always ask this question, for whose benefit, is it for theirs or is it for ours? They always say it's for our benefit, but, if they're producing a hybrid, I can't help but think that, some of them may have our planet in their sights as somewhere to live. I don't know.
Or to improve our nature.
Well, I would like to think that would be the case. We certainly need genetically upgraded, that's for sure.
Yeah.
At this time above all, I think. Because, I'm quite frankly, I'm more concerned about people on this planet than I am about people from elsewhere, even though I grant that some of them are dangerous.
Well, let me ask you this. You say that you have met with some of these aliens.
Mm-hmm.
The aliens that you met with, were they all from the same race, or have you met with several different...
I don't know. The only communication I had with them was telepathic. There was no conversation.
No physical contact.
And I tell you, I could tell you something about those stories. I might. The first two, as I said, were both in the United States, and they were both in response to a telepathic request to identify themselves if they were from someplace else. And in both cases, they did very, very dramatically and very obviously, and they certainly looked extremely interesting physically. But there was no conversation. And I had an experience last year in a certain country. People have always said to me, Tim, why don't you talk to these guys? Well, I don't know is the answer to that. One just doesn't feel like talking to them, but I did have an opportunity in a possible encounter last year, and I spoke, and there was absolutely no response at all, even though the guy was 2 feet away from me, staring straight at me. There was no verbal communication, so it doesn't make any difference, if you talk to them. I mean, let me tell you about the most interesting experience I had, which was in New York in February of 1967. I was with the London Symphony Orchestra. We had a series of concerts at Carnegie Hall,
And between the rehearsal and concert on one day, I set out to try and establish some sort of communication with these guys, because I'd been speaking with people who had had meetings in Washington. I'd just come back from Washington to talk to friends of George Adamski, who had had a craft come right low over their home in Silver Spring, Maryland, with there were a total of 4 witnesses, and Madeline Rodefer, who's alive to this day, and she'll be happy to talk to anybody on the phone. She doesn't answer letters. She's slightly arthritic and so forth, but she'd be happy to talk to people. She was there. The film has been authenticated. There's a frame in the book, in the latest book, Need to Know. I've reproduced the pictures in color in Alien Base, which is also published, and I'm absolutely convinced that that film was genuine. It was authenticated by the chief project engineer at Eastman Kodak at the time, and the craft was about 27 feet in diameter. Anyway, there were meetings, liaisons going on with some of George Adamski's co-workers and Adamski himself earlier, and I wondered if I could sort of try and make a link. And I sat in the hotel lobby of the what was then called the Park Sheraton Hotel. And I sent out a telepathic request that went something like this: you know, if there are any of you guys in the New York area, please come and sit down beside me and prove it. Okay, well, you know, you've got to be careful in New York, especially in hotel lobbies. Various people came and went. Finally, this guy comes in. He's straight out of Madison Avenue. He looks, I wasn't anywhere near Madison Avenue, by the way, I should say. I was on, I think, 7th and 57th or 6th and 57th Street, something like that. But this guy came in. He was immaculately dressed, charcoal gray suit, white shirt, dark tie, wavy fair hair, about 5'10", very intelligent looking, tanned. If I would have put a race to him, I would have said possibly Scandinavian. But anyway, he came down. He came and sat down beside me. And I thought immediately there was something about him, just his general demeanor. And he slowly opened an attaché case. Everything he did was kind of slow and deliberate and graceful. He took out the New York Times. He turned the pages over, like about one every 2 or 3 seconds. Then he folded the paper, put it back in his attaché case, closed the attaché case, and then just sat calmly there. So in my mind, I said, right, if you're from elsewhere, would you place your right index finger on the right side of your nose and hold it there? And immediately I thought that he took his finger and he held it to the side of his nose and he kept it there. Okay, so I was thinking, what do I do now? Is he going to give me the secrets of the universe or what? But I decided just to stay put and do nothing, because I thought, you know, he's going to talk or say something. But I didn't feel like speaking. I tried a bit more telepathy, but there was no more response. He just sat there. Eventually, he stood up and he just looked at me for quite a while, very dispassionately. There was no particular expression on his face. He looked extremely extremely intelligent, and he had very pleasant, though penetrating eyes. And eventually, he walked off, left the hotel. I never saw him again, but I'd recognize him again. So that was a very, very convincing experience.
Yeah, that's an amazing story.
For me. And I'd say this, you know, people would say, well, couldn't he just have been a telepathic earthling? Yes, sure, it's possible, but...
too many coincidences there.
Well, yeah. I mean, and the similar incident in 1963, and this was a girl waiting in line at a diner. We'd stopped on the 512-mile trip from Tucson to Los Angeles, and we'd stopped for a break. It was very kind of them, gave us a half-hour break to get a sandwich or something. And I just saw this extraordinary-looking, quite petite girl waiting in line, who looked quite exceptional in terms of her facial features, extremely intelligent and unusual. And so I sent out the thought, are you from elsewhere? And she had a completely deadpan expression on her face. But as she came past me, she
she did a curtsy and a huge smile, bowed, and I had friends with me who saw it, and they didn't know what was going on. And then the deadpan expression came back, and she just walked away. I've never seen her again, but I can't, quite frankly, I don't know if I would recognize her again, but she's very similar to the description of Kalna in Adamski's Inside the Spaceships.
Right. Well, I don't mean this as an insult, but could you tell me if you've ever been tested for, like, ESP?
I haven't been tested, but I've been interested in that since as long as I can remember. I mean, for example, I have attended very, very interesting seances in my late teens. With my mother, who was gifted, especially in terms of healing. And I have attended so-called direct voice seances. I have attended semi-materializations, all sorts of things. And I think the most impressive were the direct voice seances. I don't know if you're familiar with direct voice seances. That's when the medium goes in a trance, and a trumpet is projected from the medium, allegedly by ectoplasm and everything, and it comes right up into the face of the sitter. The room's usually in darkness, but there's a luminescence, there's phosphorescence around this cone, so that you can see where it's going. Now, I'm very skeptical. I've also got very long legs. So while all this was going on, the trumpet actually came right up to me in my face. So I've got my legs, and I'm sort of sticking them around in the air and everything, and there was nobody speaking through that thing, I can tell you. And it spoke to me, and I recognized the voice of my aunt. I went to another seance where a famous conductor came through who would not give his name until much, much later, until I was testing him. I won't go into all the details. I was testing him for information, which eventually came out. And he announced himself as a certain famous conductor, and my mother was present at the time. Of course, she knew him, and she knew what his voice sounded like. So this was fantastic evidence, you know, so many years ago. So I've seen all the evidence I need. And incidentally, both those mediums, I believe, were, certainly one of them, was strapped into a chair while in trance, and the jacket was all sewn up, so you know, they couldn't be responsible for what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was testing, moving my arms and everything, and there was nothing, you know, there was a disembodied cone, and voices spoke through it, definitely.
Well, here's the last question I'm going to ask you. One witness saw something through binoculars in the sky, and it was sort of a platform that had corners at each end and had turbulence above it. Yet when he took the binoculars away, even though this object was low in the sky, it was invisible. And then when he put them back on, he could see it again. The binoculars were coated. Have you ever heard of anything like this before?
No. That's very interesting.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I'm the witness. I was sitting in my backyard. I've never told anybody that it was me.
That's very interesting.
But I was sitting in my backyard, and I just happened to be looking at the sky with binoculars, and this is what I came across. It seemed to be a platform that was being slung under a helicopter. That's the only way I can describe it, because you could see the turbulence of where the blades were. But yet, when you didn't look through the binoculars, you could see nothing, no turbulence, nothing. And it made me think of these new experiments that they're conducting now with two types of invisibility, one being cameras that are above something that show what is above down below on screens, you know?
Yes.
And the other one is bending light.
Right.
And I was wondering if I just happened to be a witness to some, you know, experiment in this field.
You could well be, and incidentally, many witnesses, I'm sure you're aware, have reported seeing a sort of boiling effect around a craft sometimes. I mean, sometimes they can make themselves invisible,
they can
I don't know, probably rotate the photons around their craft 360 degrees. They can make themselves invisible if they choose, so they're still perfectly solid. But that effect has been noted, as if there's a sort of boiling effect going around. You know,
right, this was only above the craft,
yes.
Though. It wasn't below it.
No.
Okay, at this point, I'm going to allow you to say whatever you'd like to say.
Oh, my goodness me. Well,
Oh, you'll have to cue me, I think. What do you think your audience would like to know?
Well, I still have a lot of questions. I mean, I could give you a question if you'd like.
Sure.
Okay, one of my favorite questions. What do you think the U.S. seems to be avoiding taking high-resolution photos of the Cydonia region of Mars?
Short answer, I don't know. I have to say, I have never found the face convincing. I don't believe that is a face on Mars, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I do, however, think that we will definitely find traces of a previous civilization on Mars, no question.
Yeah, I sort of feel that way myself. But
I think there's a lot, you know, even in some of the pictures that get through, there's some very weird stuff.
That's for sure.
And on the moon, incidentally.
Yes, yes. Yes, like the lighted craters that the astronauts saw.
Yes. Well, now that came out recently, didn't it?
No, I've known about that for years. I've also known about this cult that has grown up around people looking at the reflection in the astronauts' visors, you know. They claim that they see all sorts of things in their visors.
Well, as you know, there were things on the moon. I mean, I published that in my first book about mm-hmm. Top Secret, and I got information from someone who spoke to Neil Armstrong, and... this lady, I can now reveal, she used to be with MI6, that's the equivalent of your CIA.
Yes, I know.
She had attended a NASA conference in Italy at which Armstrong was president. She heard from the next room, she managed to hear part of a conversation with Neil Armstrong talking with a German physicist. And the physicist says, now come along, Mr. Armstrong, tell us what really happened on the moon. And Armstrong said, yes, there were two craft there. We felt very threatened. It was quite frightening and blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
You know the rest. Then she put this to Armstrong the next day, confronted him, and he said, yes, it's true, but the CIA ordered a complete cover-up on it, and that's the way it has to be. Something words to that effect. And, of course, as you know, Buzz Aldrin came out last year
right.
in a British
mm-hmm.
document. I think it's a British documentary called Apollo 11, The Untold Story, that Apollo 11 was paced on the way to the moon.
Well, the Russians supposedly have come out with have contributed to a documentary showing the Mir space station being surrounded by unidentified flying objects. Have you seen that?
No.
Yes, it's on YouTube.
Okay.
I don't have the name of it at the tip of my finger,
but
I'll send it to you.
If you can email it to
yeah,
me,
sure,
I'd be most
sure.
interested in that, because, of course, the Soviet astronauts, cosmonauts, as they call themselves,
right.
have had several encounters, as you know, and there's a lot of stuff going on. I'd like to say that the most extraordinary encounter that we've had this year in the United Kingdom took place in April, in French airspace in the British Channel Islands.
Oh, I know about that one, yes.
Off the Channel Islands. And there were two airliners, small airliners involved, and a mile-wide UFO was seen. And at first it was denied that it had seen on radar, but it did actually register as a primary contact. So this was a solid mm-hmm. object at least a mile wide, and the captain of the Aurigny Airlines plane, Captain Ray Barrio, said he was just absolutely dumbstruck by this, and the passengers saw it as well, and he was trying to equate it with, you know, like the size of an MD-80 or something like that, you know,
well,
like
I've
10
seen
miles away, but he figured it out, yeah. They figured it out, and the radar, and everything, and it was about a mile wide.
Well, I've seen now where he sort of recanted a little bit on that, saying that because of the distance that he was from the object, that it may not have been as big as he thought. At least that's what I read on the
okay.
internet.
Okay. Well, I have an interview with him on which I've got off Google UFO alerts,
mm-hmm.
which is on my website in the latest news section.